quite a good deal happening this week vis-a-vis the parshas. We have a double Sedra Vayakal Pekudei, and it's Para, and it's Chazak. And, of course, as we can appreciate, there's a great deal to talk about. But I would like to begin our discussion by paying some attention to the opening of the first of our two parshas, Vayakel Moshe. And that's how the parsha begins. Vayakel Moshe, Skaladas B'nai Yisrael, Vayomer Aleihem, he gathers the B'nai Yisrael together to tell them about the Mishkan. And it's very interesting that this is not the first thing that the Moshe has told the B'nai Yisrael. It's not the first, it's not the last. As a matter of course, the Torah tends to refer to these messages as Vayidaber Moshe, Kol B'nai Yisrael. If he's speaking to them, then they're there. But here, the Pasuk preface, there is a preamble, whereby before we get to the things that Moshe said to B'nai Yisrael, we have Moshe assembling B'nai Yisrael, Vayakel Moshe, Eskol Adas B'nai Yisrael. And the Medrash talks about this. It's a Medrash in the Psikta Zutrasi, and it's quoted by Rabbeinu Bachya. And there's a very sobering overtone in this Vayakel. For the Medrash says that the Vayakel, as a prelude to the building of the Mishkan, is coming as a tikkun, as a rectification, for an earlier kihila, for an earlier assembly. For the truth is that the beginnings of the Chet HaEgel, which is in last week's parsha, Perek Lamed Beis, Pasuk Aleph, Vayar ha'am ki voshesh Moshe laredis minahar, they saw Moshe was tarrying. Vayikahel ha'am al Aaron, the nation assembled around Aaron with their idea of the Egel, and the rest, as we know, is history, our history. That is the first time the verb kahal is used with regards to the B'nai Yisrael, and it is etched in infamy for us. And part of the Vayakel of the Mishkan is in order to give the Jewish people an orientation as to the things that they should be assembled around. So not only is the building of the Mishkan a tikkun for the making of the Egel, but the getting together around the venture of the building of the Mishkan is a tikkun for the getting together for the making of the Egel. For that itself is an entity. That itself is a concept, that group dynamic. And in a sense, we're being told a rather unsettling message. We speak about the unity of the Jewish people, the power of Achdus, the power of the Tzibur, and it's all true. But there is a certain disclaimer. There is a certain Bamed Dvarim Amurim. For as much as we would say that the unity of the Jewish people is a positive thing and a powerful thing, it is not a categorically positive thing. As if to say anything the Jewish people could conceivably get together around will then by definition be positive, because the first thing they got together around was the Egel Hazav. And therefore, the dynamic of the Koach of the Tzibur, it's a power, but there's a responsibility to harness it and give it a positive orientation, because that is not a given. It's most interesting. This idea brings to mind a statement of Rav Kook in his Chiddushei Agodos, the beginning of the seventh parak of Maseches Brachos, which talks about Shloshe She'ochlu Ke'echad, and as we know, that's where we have the halachas of Zimun. And it's interesting. Many things that, until we think about them, until we just look at them as in a simple way, we may miss the message. When a yochid an individual, he eats bread, so he benches. Then when there's three or more, and sometimes up to ten, and then it changes again, there's a zimun. And why? Or what are we to make of this? Of course, we understand Barabam Hadras Melech, but we don't find, actually, in other areas that as soon as you have three people doing the same thing, you add on another bracha. But we do when it comes to benching. And the reason why, says Rav Kook, is that benching itself, in a sense, is to give an orientation to the act of eating. The staple of life, al alechem. When a person has a bread-based meal, so that can lead them in any number of directions. It could be ve'ochalta v'savato v'erachta. It could be ve'ochal v'sava v'dashen. It could lead them to a feeling of connectedness, of tachlis. What will they do now? Or perhaps it can lead them to a feeling of self-satisfaction and perhaps disconnect them. To that end, benching gives an orientation to the physical act of eating. And, says Rav Kook, when three people eat together, there's another dynamic. There's another dimension. There's a group dynamic. And that's also something that needs to be harnessed. Because that's also something that could take them in any given direction. It could lead them further towards tachlis, towards things that are good and proper and Torahdik. It could lead them further away. They could feed off each other. Pardon the expression. And so, the Zimun is to people what benching is to food. There's three of you, be sure to use that dynamic correctly. Harness it into another bracha. Use the fact that you're together to make the benching even more powerful. It's a very interesting idea. And the moral of the story, again, is that the unity per se cannot, by definition, be the ultimate aim, which could justify any means. Because if you're unified around something that takes us further away from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so then it's not worth the benefit of the unity itself. And I mention this specifically within the context of these parshas, these four or five parshas that are devoted to Inyonei HaMishkan, because as we know, there was a famously reported conversation between Moshe, between the two people that were the overseers of the making of the Mishkan. Moshe, who relays the messages, and Bezalel, who's in charge. And the pasuk tells us in the beginning of Parshas Pekudei, Uvitzalel ben Uri ben Hur l'matei Yehuda, Bezalel, as we call him, Asa es kol asher tziva Hashem es Moshe. He acted in accordance with the way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded Moshe. And the Medrash comments, and Rashi quotes it, that what that means to say is that the emphasis is that he acted in accordance with the way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu instructed Moshe and not in accordance with the way that Moshe instructed him. Because Moshe actually shifted, he tweaked the order somewhat. And it's reported as well in the Maseches Brachos and Daf Nun Hei Amud Aleph, whereby the Mishkan is divided broadly into the body of the Mishkan and then the vessels of the Mishkan. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe to tell Bezalel to make the Mishkan and then the Kenim. Moshe came to Bezalel and told him to make the Kenim and then the Mishkan. And Bezalel's response to this was very enigmatic. Bezalel says, Minhag shel olam, that's the way of the world, that doesn't seem to be that reasonable to a way to go about things. I mean, you make your furniture, you make your utensils before having a place to put them. Minhag shel olam, a person first makes a house, builds a house, and then he buys the furniture, not the other way around. Perhaps, this is Bezalel continues, perhaps HaKadosh Baruch Hu really said, I'm wondering if he said to you to make first the body of the Mishkan first and then the Kelim, and Moshe concurred. Very mysterious exchange. And of course the burning question is, Mara'a al-Kocha, what does Moshe see the value of? It seems he's almost testing Bezalel, perhaps in a way. What is the benefit? What is the positive outcome of reversing the order of these things? That Moshe presents to him first the Kelim and then the Mishkan. What is he trying to communicate? And there are many, many explanations and interpretations of this exchange. But there is one that I found to be particularly impactful, which is referred to by Rabbi Avraham Gurewitz, Shlita, the Rosh Hashiva of Gateshead, in the name of his father, Reb Leib. And it begins with a comment of the Vilna Gaon in his Peirush to Shir HaShirim. There, the Pasuk says, Kimigdal David Tzavareich Banui Letalpios. The Pasuk in Shir HaShirim. And those words, Banui Letalpios, actually have halachic impact, as we will see. For the Gaon refers to that Gemara. The Gemara it gives us a halach in Hilchus Tefillah. Which way does a person face? So, as we know our Mishnayos and in Maseches Brachos, it depends where you are. If you're in Chutz La'aretz, you face towards Eretz Yisrael. If you're in Eretz Yisrael, you face towards Yushalayim. Yushalayim to the Mishkan. Mishkan closer and closer. It turns out, says the Gemara, Nimsa, Kol Yisrael mechavnin lemakom echad. It turns out that everyone is facing the same place. And with this in mind, the Talmud adduces this pasuk in Shir HaShirim, Banui letalpios. What does Banui letalpios have to do with davening and which way you face? Says the Gemara, talpios is a contracted form of the word tel pios. Tel is the mound, tel is the hill. That's Har HaMoria, Pios. All mouths face inwards. Tel Shekol Pios Ponimbo. Every mouth faces towards that hill. And interestingly, that halacha remains true today, parenthetically. Of course, as we know, even when all we have is the hill, when all we have is the mountain, it remains Shar HaShamayim. And it never occurred to me to ask, why is it so? Why is it so important for all of the Jewish people to face the same place when they daven? Because I thought that the answer was very simple, and perhaps it's part of the answer, that we call it Shara Shamayim, that's the place where the tefillahs go through, and therefore everybody, wherever you are, if you're north, south, east and west, you face towards the Kodesh HaKadoshim, because that's where your tefillahs will be accepted. But along came the Vilna Gaon, and introduced an entirely new dimension to this idea, which is fascinating. And he says, he begins his comments on this pasuk Banu Letalpios with a reference to the beginning of Parshas Truma. V'asu li mikdash v'shachanti besocha. So the Jewish people are to make the mikdash, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu dwells within them. And as we know, and it's actually a medrash, that the pasuk does not say v'shachanti besocho, as much as we talk about when the mikdash is there, the Shekhinah resides in the mikdash. But the pasuk says v'shachanti besocham, when they make the mikdash, I will dwell in them. And what that means is besoch Yisrael, amongst the Jewish people themselves. And says the Gaon, this is the meaning of everybody facing the same place when they daven. He adduces this Gemara. What's this Gemara got to do with v'shachanti besocha? So the Gaon explains. Ki shiriyas hashchina haisa besoch lev Yisrael. The correct resting place, dwelling place of the Shechina, is within the hearts of the Jewish people. Except, there is one qualification required. Namely, in order for the Shechina to dwell within the Jewish people need to be unified. They need to be unified physically as far as possible, and they need to be unified ideologically. because when the Jewish people are unified, then they represent the composite entity that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is attached to. Velochein, it is to that end, Bachar Mokam Muvchar, HaKadosh Baruch Hu chose the choice place, Eretz Yisrael. Sheshamu Muchan Lashuas Hashchina. In other words, the ideal is for Bnei Yisrael to be together in Eretz Yisrael, because when they are together, the Shechina will be amongst them. But then the Gaon says further, because the truth of the matter is that the unification of the Jewish people around the Mikdash doesn't start when it's built. It starts when it's being built. And he says, Ve'ech yis yachdu kol halavavos shall kol Yisrael biyachad. How is it possible to unify the hearts of the Jewish people? Lachein tziva HaKadosh Baruch Hu ve'yikhu li truma. It is to that end HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, let them all take truma. And what that means is, let everyone donate what he feels that he would like to, ashe yedvenu libo, v'kol echad hisnadev kifi nidvas libo ala mishkan. Everybody gave what he was capable of, what he wanted to give, and now these final two words of the Gaon, v'nischabru halavavos. And thus were the hearts of the Jewish people unified. And that is an amazing thing. In other words, according to the Vilna Gaon, the project, the venture of the creation of the Mikdash is a way to unify the Jewish people around a holy endeavor. Once they are all, they have that orientation, they're all aligned towards that central point, together around it, whether it is initially through their donations, all contributing to it, whether it is subsequently everybody, wherever they are, they daven facing towards it, the effect is the same, and the result is v'shachanti b'socha. And this is a really fascinating way of understanding what is happening when everybody the world over faces the same place when they daven. We understand that it's an individual dividend for each person if they want their tefillahs to be accepted. So face the right way, and even if there's only one Jew alive, he'd face that way because that's the way to face. So if there's, Baruch Hashem, millions of Jews alive, so they all face that way for the same reason. But it's just the same thing multiplied by a number of millions. But that's not what's happening at all. There is a unifying effect that is being produced by everybody facing inwards towards the same place. And it is exactly the same thing as the Asu L'Mikdash in the first place. And the result is B'Shachanti B'Socham. Says Reb Leib Gurwitz, it's such a delicate idea, but so elegant. Moshe wishes to appraise Bezalel of the nature of the Mishkan. Bezalel, of course, the Torah spares no praise for Bezalel. He's full of chokhmah, tevuna, vadas. But Bezalel says, it is the minhagar shel olam. Is it not the way of the world that the person first makes the house and then he builds the kelim? Because that's the relationship of house to kelim. First house, then kelim. And ultimately, and practically, Moshe concurs. It's correct. But Moshe made a point of reversing them the first time round and told him first make the kelim and then the house. Why? What is he looking to communicate? The idea, says Reb Leib, is that Moshe wishes to ensure that Bezalel understands that the relationship of the Mishkan to the Kelim is not a typical relationship of house to vessels. For the simple reason that the Mishkan itself is not a house. What is meant to be housed here? What is meant to be housed is the Shekhinah. Ultimately, the housing of the Shekhinah is B'socham. Is within the Bnei Yisrael. And to that end, the Mishkan itself is a kli. And therefore, Moshe mentions the Kelim first, and then the Mishkan, as if to indicate that from a certain point of view, the Mishkan is on the list of Kelim. It's also a kli. Because as surely as those kelim exist to serve the Mishkan itself is a kli to serve the Bnei Yisrael because they are the ultimate house for the Shekhinah, v'shachanti besocham, and therefore he treats it no differently than he would treat another of the kelim. Once that has been established, that the Mishkan ultimately is a means to an end of the Jewish people housing the Shekhinah, then they get down to business. Minhago shel olam, of course, is first to make the Mishkan and then to put the kelim inside. But this, I believe, is the ultimate expression of Vayakhel, the way we see the Vilna Gaon explaining the function. Not only that one meeting of Vayakhel, but the Beis HaMikdash is an ongoing Vayakhel to ensure that the Jewish people are always assembled around Devarim Shebekedusha as an ongoing rectification of the original assembly around the Egel itself. So, that's a very heavy word to open the parsha. Vayakhel Moshe is a message and a challenge. Now, halachically, the parsha of Vayakhel has much to say, even though in terms of Va'asu the Mikdash, we are temporarily not involved in building the Mishkan, but as we know, whatever went on in the building of the Mishkan tells us a great deal about something which is a regular feature of our Torah lives, namely the halachas of Shabbos. For whatever they needed to in order to build the Mishkan, the 39 productive labors to build the Mishkan is exactly what is to be refrained from on Shabbos, and that's learned from the Smichus Parshas, from the juxtaposition, and more specifically, Moshe gets them together to tell them about the Mishkan, and first things first, Shabbos. Zeh adavar shetiv Hashem, sheshes yomim, teaseh, melocha, etc. That has to be established, and then we'll get on to the Mishkan. Shabbos comes first, and the Mishkan is not docheh the day of Shabbos. And from time to time we focus on various aspects of malachos that we learn from the Mishkan. And this year I wanted to look at one malacha, which will, as the discussion develops, will soon become more than one malacha. It will represent a group of malachos. The malacha in question is Koreya, which is tearing. Now as we know, we don't tear things on Shabbos. A possible exception would be wrapping around food, of course, taking care not to tear through any letters or writing or any of anything they care to put on the wrapping of the food, nutritional information, or the lack thereof. But being able to avoid all of that, the wrapping itself, in a sense, we tend to look upon it like the shell, like an eggshell or like a peel of fruit, and one should open before, but it's mutter to open on Shabbos. But other things, materials that are together to tear them apart, of course, everybody knows that's off limits. That's a malach of Korea. It's one of the 39. Now, interestingly, Korea is one of those malachos that has a partner. And sometimes you have that. It's like, it has an opposite number. Because it's really the undoing of stitching. As surely as we have bone of a soser, building and demolishing or two of the 39. Kosev and mochek, writing and erasing or two of the 39. And so too, tofer, which is attaching things, and then korea is detaching them, ripping them apart. Now, the malacha of korea should not need much of an introduction. What does one need to do? To tear. And that's the malacha. But as we know, sometimes There are specifications in order for a person to have violated the malacha on a Torah level. And here, the Tosfos in Masechet Shabbos, Daf Ayin Gimel, say the following. In order to violate the malacha of Koreya, of tearing, on a Torah level, a person needs to tear with the intention of restitching. But if that's not the case, then it is not a violation of Korea on a Torah level. Of course, as we know in our experience, all tearing is off limits. That's Midrabanon, to protect the malachas. but on a Torah level, it has to be with the intention of restitching. Otherwise, it's not Karin. Now, what's most interesting here, and this is the delicate point that needs to be stated clearly, and Rabbi Kiva Eger steps in here to make Seder. Be sure not to misunderstand what the Tosfos just said. You may have understood that the Tosfos mean their words to be taken in a very general way, as if to say, one of the principles of Shabbos is, if you ruin something, so then you're exempt on a Torah level. As a rule, kol ha-mekalkelin peturin. If you're mekalkel, if you what you do is destructive in nature, so it's potter. Now, if that's true, then you may have understood that when the Tosfos say it needs to be with the intention to restitch, the Tosfos just mean to ensure that there should be some positive outcome from this act. Otherwise, it languishes in the category of mekalkalin, and you'd be exempt. Says Rabbi Kiva Eger, do not misunderstand that the Tosfos. Do not understand that that's what they mean to say. Not so. Rather, no positive outcome is acceptable other than the specific intention to restitch. That's it. Any other positive outcome is not a violation on a Torah level. And what's interesting is, we should note that when the Mishnah originally presents the 39 malachos, and it talks about the malacha of Korea, so it starts with stitching, hatofesh te tefiros, one, and one who stitches two stitches, and then when it presents the malacha of tearing, it presents it as follows, the hakorea almanas litvor shtei tefiros, a person who tears with the intention of restitching. So what's interesting is the Mishnah itself has given it that name, has described it as such. That seems to be the definition of the malacha. But if it's for any other outcome than restitching, then there's no violation on a Torah level. I made a point of saying that two or three times, because we will be ready to hear what the Rambam has to say. The Rambam in Hilchos Shabbos talks about the malacha of tofer, and he moves on to speak about the tolda. As we know, malachas in Shabbos are 39 families of malachas. There's parents and children, avos and tolados. There are extended malachas. What is a tolda of tofer? What's a tolda of stitching? The Rambam says a tolda of stitching is sticking things together, gluing things together, is an extension. It's a child of the stitching family. So the av is with a needle and thread. And the tolda is any way that you attach two things together through that third agent. It's not thread, it's glue. That's a tolda. And of course, if the tolda of stitching is gluing, then the tolda of tearing would be ripping things apart that have been glued together. And these are his words. Hamidabek niyaros. If a person attaches papers, Oros, or pieces of leather, bekolon shel sofrim, with glue, hareze toldas tofer v'chayev. That is a tolda of the malach of stitching and his chayev. V'chein, hamefarek niaros devukim. If he detaches papers that are stuck together, v'lo niskaven likalkel bilvad, and he didn't have a destructive intention, Hareza told us Korea the Chayev. So that's a tolda of tearing, and he's Chayev. Now, of course, what is so significant about these words of the Rambam? He doesn't seem to have stated anything outrageous. But the point is, of course, that the Rambam has designated as Chayev anyone who tears without destructive intent. And the implication is that as long as your intent wasn't destructive, just to ruin things, you'll be chayev. So what will make you chayev? A positive intent. What type? Any type. And therefore, what emerges from the words of the Rambam is that he is taking issue with the Tosfos. The Tosfos had a very specific orientation with regards to tearing. There will only be one intention that will make you liable for the malach of tearing on a Torah level, namely the intention to restitch. Any other positive intention, zelo ze, as they say. As far as the Rambam is concerned, as long as it's not negative, you're liable. And the question, of course, that we need to ask is, what is the basis of this dispute? Why did Tosfos require such a specific intent? And why for the Rambam is it so open? And the answer, say the Mefarshim, will really open up for us this entire group of malachos that we could really call the malachos of undoing. Everybody knows it's a malacha to tear. It's one of the 39. By the same token, and we've mentioned these a few moments ago, it's a malacha to demolish a building. It's a malacha to erase writing. It's a malacha to put out a fire. I mean, these are a good half dozen of the 39. They all have something in common. They are the undoing of the opposite number. For building has demolishing, writing has erasing, and stitching has tearing. And of course, the question which has to be addressed is, how can these malachos, that let us call them, for want of a better expression, malachos of undoing, how can they be considered malachos at all? And the background to the question is, we always understood that the definition of a malacha is something that is productive, something that is creative, something that does. And these malachas undo. So a malacha that undoes something actually seems to be a contradiction in terms. By definition, it shouldn't be a malacha. That's a good question. And that's a question that fits about six or seven of those malachas. What's the answer to that question? Well, there's two possibilities. And they're fundamentally different. But we have to answer this question. We could say that the premise behind our question is mistaken. As if to say that we look upon everything that you undid as a regression. In other words, if you put two things together, so then you made something. And if you take them apart, so then that's a regression. Say the Mefarshim, not necessarily. There could be merits and demerits of both stages. Of course, depending that on the fact that they're not destructive. A moshel. There is a malacha, as we know, if you could find a place in the world which doesn't have an Eruv, well, if you find a place, you probably won't find a place that doesn't have an Eruv. You also won't find a place that has an Eruv that everyone relies on. In between a 99.9% of the Jewish communities and barring that, of course, there is a malacha called hotzah of carrying on Shabbos. Now the question is, okay, carrying from a private to a public domain is a malacha on Shabbos. Okay. What about from a public domain to a private domain? Also, one's called hotzah, one's called hachnasa, not surprisingly. And they're both malachas. So let's ask a simple question. One of them seems to be the undoing of the other. So which one of them is productive, and which one of them is the progression, and which one of them is the regression? But of course the answer is yes, because you cannot categorically say about either of them that they are progressive or regressive. Each one is a development in a certain direction. Each one has its merits and demerits. And perhaps if we broaden our horizons a little bit, we may understand that the same thing could be true for all of these malachas. We understood that what's called a development? Writing. And if you erase, so that is a regression. It may depend what's written. What if you made a mistake? What if you wrote something that wasn't true? That's a regression. And erasing it is actually brings you closer to the truth. What if it's an IOU for 100 shekels, which you, a debt that you have since paid? That's actually of benefit now to be erased from the world. It's no longer true. So all of a sudden, what seemed to us to be very black and white, that what takes you forward is the writing and the building, and well, it depends. If you want to make a playground, often the first step towards making a playground is leveling the building that's stopping you from playing there. As surely as the first step to building a house is digging a hole in the ground. It's not always the intuitive first step, but we know it to be true. So this is one possibility. We need to broaden our definitions of what's called development, assuming that there's a positive outcome. That's one possibility. But the other answer is quite different. The other answer is, again, the answer to our question of how can you consider the undoing of something to be a malacha? I thought a malacha is always meant to be doing something. The answer may be that all of these malachas of undoing, the reason why they're considered to be malachas is because they are actually, their status as a malacha is attributed to the fact that they prepare the way for a new malacha to take place. In other words, as steps along the way, as surely as there's a malacha to plow. Why? Because plowing prepares the ground for sowing. And there's a malacha to sow. Why? Because sowing prepares the ground, prepares for each one, in the sense that malachas often go in groups in their progressions. And each stage will allow you now to move on to the next stage. So the chiddush, in a sense, of these half a dozen or so malachas, is that we may indeed look upon them as taking one step backwards, but if it's one step backwards to take two steps forwards, then it is a malacha because you are preparing the ground for something for something positive, and that preparation already gives a positive stamp on this act. And what's fascinating to note, just to bring out this point, the Rosh, Rabbeinu Osher, states that if there's a blob of ink, now of course a blob of ink says nothing, and a person wishes to write there, so he removes the ink, he has violated the malacha of erasing. Now of course the question is, how can that be? What did he erase? There were no letters there. There was only ink. It had no form and no meaning. How can he have violated the malach of Mochek? What did he erase? The Rosh, we see, clearly looks at all of these malachas of undoing as preparation for writing. So if that's the profile of the malacha, what difference does it make if you erase existing letters in order to write something else, or you erase a blob of ink to write something else? They both take you to the same point, which is, I'm clearing the ground for writing what I'd now like to write. A blob of ink and two perfectly formed letters are both equal candidates for the malacha of Mochek. That's a very interesting expression of that idea. And of course, as we can appreciate, where we're headed towards is that this is the issue that divided the Tosfos and the Rambam. The answer to the question as to what type of intention do you need in order to have violated the malacha is really a reverberation of the question as to why these things are malachas at all. According to the Rambam, the reason why they're malachos is because he takes the first approach, that any development could in principle be positive. The question is why you're doing it. And therefore the Rambam is very open on this point. As long as you have a positive intent, you're liable. Whereas the Tosfos were more prepared, inclined to look upon all of these malachos of undoing as a step backwards. It can never be a step forwards. It can only be a step forwards or rated as such if it's preparation for the step forwards. But of course, that will have to be locked into the malacha at hand. Namely, if you're tearing, it will need to be with the intention of stitching. If it's erasing, it will need to be with the intention of the malacha of writing something else. It is only thus that these actions got the status of malachas at all, because they are preparatory acts to the subsequent writing. So this, on the one hand, is a rather delicate discussion, somewhat abstract even. And of course, as we know, practically, we steer clear of any form of tearing, of any form of erasing. Quite true, for the Rabbanim protected all of these malachas with fences around them, but it's most fascinating just to take a few moments to ponder these questions and see what the malacha, the parameters of the malacha on a Torah level, because certainly in these cases, it really takes us into a deeper understanding as to how these things come to be considered malachas at all. So that is our Shabbos discussion for Parshas Vayakel. And I would like to move from there, actually, to discuss another aspect of what is waiting for us this week. Namely, we have Vayakel, and Pekudei, and Chazak, and Parshas Parah. Now, Parshas Parah, as we know, it's one of the series of four, the Arba Parshas we call them, Shekalim, and Zohar, and Parah, and HaChodesh. And how exactly does Parshas Parah find its way into these series of four? Three of the four are instantly easy to understand. Shekalim, of course, the collection for the new Korbanos in Rosh Chodesh Nisan will need to be from new money. Olas Chodesh Bechodesh would have to, at a certain point, be from a new contributions, and that takes a month already. Actually, by today's standards, a month is relatively quick. And therefore, Shekalim starts before Rosh Chodesh Adar, so that by the time Rosh Chodesh Nisan comes, all contributions are in, and it's new Korbanos. Zohar, of course, needs no introduction. Zohar is the Chiras Maisi Amalek, and that comes the Shabbos before Purim, of course, to connect those two. HaChodesh is just before Chodesh Nisan, and that's really the beginning of, well, not only Chodesh Nisan, but the Halachos of Korban Pesach. And Parah Aduma is there, Parshas Parah is there because in order for everyone to be able to bring the Korban Pesach, they need to be Tahar. And if they're Tomei Meis, they need to undergo the Tahara of the Parah Aduma. And that is the place of Parshas Parah within these four Parshas. But what's very interesting is, the Yerushalmi raises a question. Namely, the ordering of the final two. The timing of Shekalim, we understand. You need a month, take a month. Zohar, of course, the timing is perfect. It always comes right before Purim. But Parah and HaChodesh are interesting. Why? Because HaChodesh, of course, should be sometime before Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Okay, the Shabbos before. But what about Parshas Parah? How long does it take in order for a person to avail themselves of the process of the Parah Aduma? 7 days. So actually, between Rosh Chodesh Nisan and Pesach is 2 weeks. So there's more time available for HaChodesh than you should need for Parah. You only need 7 days. HaChodesh is going to have to be 2 weeks before Pesach, because that's when Rosh Chodesh is. But Parah only needs to be 7 days. So you could conceivably reverse the order. You'd need actually to know about HaChodesh before you need to know about Parah. And we should know, historically, the original Parah Aduma was the first, that is to say, was burnt and used after Rosh Chodesh Nisan. You only need 7 days. So it could be from the 2nd to the 8th of Nisan, or from the 3rd to the 9th, or anything up to Erev Pesach. Parah should be last. That's the question of the Yerushalmi. It's an interesting shaila. And the answer is equally interesting. Very simple, as explained by the Mefarshi HaYerushalmi. The reason why you need to read Parshas Parah the week before Parshas HaChodesh is because the Parah Aduma is only available in Yerushalayim. And people need to get there in order to use the Parah Aduma. So now the question is, well, how long does it take to get to Yerushalayim? I mean, what is the rated radius? Well, actually, the answer to that question we know. Because from elsewhere in the Halacha, after Sukkot, we only begin asking for rain, we here in Eretz Yisrael, on the 7th of Mar Cheshvan. Why the 7th of Mar Cheshvan? Why not straight after Sukkot? As soon as your schach is down and back in the machsan, you're safe. Why do we wait 2 weeks? So this is yet a spillover, pardon the expression, from the time of the Beis HaMikdash, of Aliyah L'Regel, where it would take 2 weeks in order for people to get back, until they got back from as far as they would come for Aliyah L'Regel. Ad Sheyagia Acharon L'Nahar Paras, to get to the Euphrates would take 2 weeks. And that was considered the circle of Aliyah L'Regel. It's very interesting. I mean, we're almost there, actually. It's recorded that someone once asked Reb Shlomo Zalman Orbach, before he was Reb Shlomo Zalman Orbach, when he was a child of 7 years old, he asked him an interesting shaila. Namely, we don't start saying V'sein Talumata Levracha until 2 weeks after Sukkot. Why? In order to give the travelers those 2 weeks grace, they should get home, and they shouldn't get rained on for their travels. So we delay V'sein Talumata Levracha until 2 weeks after Sukkot. So this person asks, the young Shlomo Zalman Orbach, so if that's the case, then on the other side, we should also stop saying V'sein Talumata Levracha 2 weeks before Pesach. Because the very same people that it takes 2 weeks for them to get back will take them 2 weeks to get to. And we don't want them to get rained on either way. Which is a good shaila. Because we happen to say V'sein Talumata Levracha all the way up to Pesach. And Rav Shlomo Zalman answered on the spot. I can't bring myself not to call him Rav Shlomo Zalman, even though he's only 7 years old. But the answer that he gave was that the problem of being rained on is not so much of a problem if you leave home knowing that it's raining. In other words, if it's still in the rainy season, but you have all of your wherewithal as you leave home, make provisions. Our problem is not that they'll be rained on, our problem is that they'll be caught in the rain, because when they came it was summer, and they're dressed for summer, and they come back and they get rained on. And therefore, if they came in Sukkot, in their summer garb, then we don't want them getting rained on the way back. But if it's still raining by the time they make their face off, so bring a coat. That was his answer. It's a very interesting answer, and to date, I haven't found a better answer to the question. Maybe it's the right answer. So, in any event, says the Yerushalmi, this being the case, the truth of the matter is the correct timing for Para Aduma is exactly where it is. A week and a little bit before Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Because that gives you the 2 weeks that are rated, certainly at that time, to get from wherever you are to Yerushalayim, plus the 7 days to use the Para Aduma. It should be before Parshas HaChodesh. That's the answer of the Yerushalmi. And that's how Parah comes to be before Achodesh. Now, there is another noteworthy feature of Parshas Parah, and it is mentioned twice in the Shulchan Aruch. Kriyas HaTorah, which we have regularly during the week and on Shabbos and Yom Tov, is Derabbanan. It's a very early takana. The original takana of Kriyas HaTorah is from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, who was the first of the Rabbanan. When you think about it, aside from giving us Tariq Mitzvahs, his own enactments are Drabbanan and the Vim of his time. And Ezra added a little bit more. These are of the earliest Takanas that we have, but they are Drabbanan. Okay. There is an exception, as we know, which was last week. The exception of, just before Purim, the exception of Zohar. And the reason why is that Zohar is actually a Torah Mitzvah. As the Torah says, Zohar eis asher asol lecho amole. And the Gemara in Maseches Megillah, Darshans and Daf Yud Ches, that it means you need to talk about it, and which becomes translated and you need to read it. The reading of Parsha Zohar is virtually exceptional, because every other laning is to Rabbanon, but the reading of Zohar is to Araisa. And that's more or less well known. That's how things stand. The Shulchan Aruch, in Simen Kuf Mem Vav, Si'if Beis, which is Hilchos Kriyas HaTorah, and later on in Simen Tafresh Pehe, Si'if Zayin, says there is another laning that is Min HaTorah, that is a Torah mitzvah. And that is Parshas Parah. The Shulchan Aruch, whenever he talks about Zohar, he mentions Parah together. Parshas Zachor and Parshas Parah are both De'oraisa, Torah mitzvahs. Now, in terms of halachic authorities, the source of the Shulchan Aruch is a Tosfos in Maseches Brachos and Daf Yud Gimel, and there are other Rishonim also of this opinion, the Ritva in Maseches Megillah and Daf Yud Zayin. Although it's an enormous debate and discussion between the Tosfos and it gets involved in Nuschaos and Girsaos and the like, but nonetheless, what the Shulchan Aruch saw as authoritative was the Tosfos who said Zachor and Parah are both min haTorah. But of course, the question is, why? Tosfos said it, but if you say that something is min haTorah, you need to be able to expect to find it in the Torah. Now, Zachor, of course, is very simple. We've mentioned already, Zachor and Altishkach gives you Parsha Zachor. The Torah told you to remember Amalek, so that's Minat Torah. The laning becomes the fulfillment of that mitzvah, Minat Torah. But where is Parsha's Parah Minat Torah? Well, there are a number of very interesting answers to this question, and I would like to present two of them. This first is from the Sefer Avodas Yisrael, which is a Sefer I'm not familiar with, but I saw quoted, and he says something very interesting. The answer will take us into the heart of Parshas Parah, and it will force us to ask a question that perhaps we would not otherwise have asked. This is how the laning begins. The beginning of Parshas Chukas, as we know. Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe v'al Aaron le'mor. Okay, Zos Chukas HaTorah. Asher tzivo Hashem le'mor. Daber o b'nei Yisrael. V'ikru elecha parah aduma, tamima, etc., etc. Now, the question is there anything noteworthy from a Parshanut point of view? And the answer is, there most certainly is. Because if we read again and pause at the appropriate places, we will highlight a very interesting question. Again, the pasuk is Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe v'al Aharon Lemor. Zos Chukas HaTorah Asher Tzivo Hashem Lemor. Daber al Bnei Yisrael, etc., etc. Now the question is, what is the meaning of the word Lemor? It's a very difficult word to translate. If you translate it as saying, so in a sense you've given up. Because whenever anyone speaks, they're saying something, hopefully. Now many Mefarshim say that the word Lemor means to say. It's actually, it is an infinitive verb, Lemor, to say. And what that means is that when we say, which we say so often, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe Lemor, means Hashem spoke to Moshe to say the following, Lemor. And that's perfect. And if we apply that here, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe v'al Aaron Lemor, Hashem told Moshe and Aaron to say the following, to present the following parsha to Bnei Yisrael. Okay. But if that's true, then we'll get stuck in the next pasuk, which says, Zos Chukas HaTorah Asher Tzivo Hashem Lemor. Because what does that mean? We've already had the Lemor for the Moshe and Aaron to tell Bnei Yisrael. What then is the second Lemor? It's standing there, not doing anything. Says the Sefer Avodas Yisrael, it's actually doing something very important. That second, the word Lemor, is the source of the Tosfos that the mitzvah of the reading of Parah Aduma is a Torah mitzvah. Because Lemor means to say. And therefore HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe and Aaron Lemor, say the following to Bnei Yisrael, Zos Chukas HaTorah, and this is the beginning of the presentation, Zos Chukas HaTorah Asher Tzivah Hashem Lemor. This is the mitzvah of Parah Aduma that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has commanded to speak about. That second Lemor is Ladoros. That's the source of the mitzvah of Parshas Parah. It's very interesting. I mean, when you look upon it that way, it's staring you right in the face. Okay. That's one approach which I found to be very appealing and certainly thought-provoking. There is another approach which is to be found in a number of Mefarshim. The Malbim has a halachic work, although of course he's famous for his perush on the Tanakh. That's his magnum opus, but his first work before he wrote on the Chumash and the Tanakh was a halachic work. I think he wrote it when he was 19. It's called Artos HaChayim, and it's a work on Orachayim. I think he only got as far as Hilchos Tefillin, and then he stopped. And most people who read it stop way before then, because it is very heavy going. It is highly involved halachic discussions. But just a nugget le'inyanenu from Simon Ches of the Artos HaChayim. He has a fascinating comment, and others concur with him. Our question is, Parshas Parah, Min HaTorah, I mean, that's what we're being told. That's what the Tosfos say. That's what the Shulchan Aruch said. So, as we mentioned, pardon the expression, the burning question is, well, how does it come to be Min HaTorah? Says the Malbim, you know, in Parshas Ekev, there's an interesting mitzvah. It reads, and those who have the minhag of saying the Sheish Zechiros, those six remembrances after Shachris, this is one of them. Zachor al tishkach eis asher hiktzavta es Hashem elokecha bamidbar. Remember, do not forget that which you angered Hashem bamidbar. Now the context of that Zachor is actually with reference to the Chet HaEgel. And that's very interesting. Because it turns out that although we may never have reckoned with it as such, there is a mitzvah in the Torah to remember the Chet HaEgel. Zachor al tishkach eis asher tzavtos Hashem elokecha bamidbar. Except, where do we do that? And we read Parshas Kisiso, but that's part of Kriyas HaTorah. Says the Malbim, Parshas Parah is a fulfillment of the mitzvah of Zachor Asheis Asher Iktzavtos Hashem Elokecha Bamidbar. It's a fulfillment of the mitzvah of the Egel. There are many things that we do, but we do them in a slightly euphemistic way, Mishum Kavodam Shel Yisrael, in order to reflect and retain the dignity of Bnei Yisrael. And therefore the question is there any way to remember the Egel without dredging up the blow-by-blow creation of the Egel? The answer is yes, Parah Aduma. Because Parah Aduma, as we know, is a kapara for the Chet HaEgel. Tavo ha'em, v'tikaneh tzoas ha'ben. And therefore, says the Malbim, when we read Parah Aduma, it is a respectful way. And that's also part of the message of the Torah. Kvodom Shel Yisrael is also important, especially if you wish to try and do better, you need to hear a message of respect, which tells you that you can do better. Because if all you hear is everything that you ever did wrong, so then the moral of the story is, so you can't get anything right. And that's not what the mitzvah is about at all. And therefore, when things are presented in that way, Mishum Kvodim Shel Yisrael, if we're prepared to hear the messages, as indeed Moshe's opening Tochacha and Sefer Devarim is all Mishum Kvodim Shel Yisrael, only places, the Hamevin Yovin, that's how we open. The first salvo is respect. And therefore, when the Bnei Yisrael hear that the way that the Halacha wants them to remember the Egel is B'derech Kavod, that perhaps, maybe more than anything else, is inspiration to do our best to rise away from that, to remember it, to learn from it. And that's also part of the Torah that leads us back to the Korban Pesach, the beginnings of our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to get back to that point, L'chadesh Yameinu K'kedem. We'll leave it over there for this evening.